Thank you very much, Robert, and it's a real pleasure for me to be in Hobart today, especially on such a glorious morning outside. And I'd like to thank Vincia as well very much for the invitation to be here. My remarks this afternoon are really going to be centred around the Australian labour market. I want to pick up on two important themes. The first is one that the Reserve Bank has spoken about a lot over recent times, and that's structural change. And today I want to focus on how this change has affected the operation of the Australian labour market. The second issue is a more timely one, and that is how recent developments in the labour market can help us better understand the current balance between supply and demand in the overall economy. Now, no doubt you've all heard much discussion over recent years about structural change in Australia and why it's occurring. At the centre of many of the changes that are taking place is the industrialisation and the growth in Asia. This is resulting in very high prices for Australia's commodity and food exports and a high exchange rate. The most obvious effect of this is the rapid expansion of the resources sector, and that's been underway for some years now. Another important factor has been the marked change in Australia's propensity to borrow, to buy assets, especially houses. And then there's the ongoing growth in demand for services as our incomes grow and our population ages. Really, just as other factors have done for more than 200 years, these factors are reshaping our economy and they're going to continue to do so. The concept of structural change, which economists love talking about, is a fairly abstract one for most people. It does become very real, though, when it affects people's jobs, when it affects the nature of their work, the industries they're employed in, the security of their employment, their career opportunities, and the wages they get paid. Now, the Reserve Bank must, by the nature of our responsibilities, focus on the aggregate outcomes for the country as a whole. However, we also try to understand what's going on beneath these aggregates and how people's lives are being affected as a result. Before I talk about the detail, I want to start off with the aggregate unemployment rate, which you can see in my first chart here. The key point is that the unemployment rate remains low. In the past 30 years, there have only been 4 years in which the unemployment rate has averaged below its current 5.25%. It's not without exaggeration to say that Australia has one of the lowest unemployment rates amongst the advanced economies, and that's an outcome that seemed improbable for much of my professional career. But underneath this low and steady unemployment rate, there's a great deal of movement at the individual worker level. Although it's still typical for most people to have relatively long tenure in a single job, a large number of people change jobs each year. And the latest data available from the Australian Bureau of Statistics show that as at February this year, around 2.3 million people, that's almost one-fifth of the total labour force, were newly employed having been in a job for less than 1 year. While a little under half of these were starting work for the first time or were not previously working, 1.2 million people moved from one job to another over the year. And that's in a year where net employment growth, as at least published by the ABS, was just 23,000 people. Now, this changing of jobs occurs for a whole range of reasons. Around three quarters are voluntary, including for personal reasons or to take advantage of new opportunities. The remaining quarter are involuntary, including because the previous employer went out of business or the nature of the business has changed. Now, the structural changes in the economy are clearly one factor contributing to this movement of people. This is, of course, not something that's new. There's always been a degree of structural change occurring, and the strong growth in the resources sector is but the latest example of this. Nevertheless, there is some evidence that the changes taking place have led to a higher rate of job turnover in recent times than has been the case for the past two decades. And I hope you can see that in this next graph. The number of people who left a job over the year to February 2012 as a share of total employment was the highest in two decades, and there were fairly high rates of both voluntary and involuntary changes. Now, the high rate of turnover with relatively modest aggregate employment growth is consistent with a lot of new job opportunities opening up in some parts of the economy, and at the same time, other jobs ceasing to exist. Another indication of this is that the official measure of job vacancies has remained quite high, yet employment growth has been relatively subdued. Now, an additional way of looking at these changes is to look at the dispersion or the standard deviation in employment growth across the 19 industries for which the ABS currently publishes data. And you can see the results of that here. For a number of years now, there's been a high dispersion of employment growth across these 19 industries. There's obviously been very strong growth in the resources sector. The cumulative effect of this dispersion in growth rates can be seen in the figures for total employment in different industries, which are shown here. Since 2007, around 300,000 net new jobs have been created in the healthcare sector. 200,000 jobs in professional and scientific services. Around 130,000 jobs in both the mining and in the education sectors. In contrast, the number of manufacturing jobs has declined by around 70,000, and the number of jobs in retailing has hardly changed over this period. Now, these disparate trends have added to a general sense of uncertainty in many parts of our community. Job losses can be very disruptive when they occur. They tend to be more visible than job gains, and they sometimes take place all at once when firms are downsizing or closing, rather than the more gradual process of job creation. Now, this large variation experience across industries is probably one reason why many people view the labour market at the moment to be quite weak. As you can see from this chart, over the past year, we've had the rather unusual situation in which consumers report that they are very concerned about rising unemployment, yet the overall unemployment rate has been quite steady. Historically, that's quite an unusual outcome. Perhaps more positively, and to the surprise of many people, the significant variation in employment growth across industries has not led to greater variation in unemployment rates across the country. One way of seeing this is to compare the distribution of unemployment rates across the 68 regions for which the ABS publishes data with the distribution of unemployment rates 10 years ago. Here, the picture's pretty clear. The average unemployment rate is lower than it was a decade ago, and the variation of unemployment rates across the country is also lower. Today, around half the regions have unemployment rates below 5%, and 50 of the 68 regions have an unemployment rate below 6%. In only three regions is the unemployment rate above 8%. A decade ago, there were 13 regions with an unemployment rate above 8%. Now, one factor that has played at least some role in these outcomes is the willingness of people to travel and to move to where the jobs are. The most high-profile example of this is perhaps the FIFO, the fly-in, fly-out workers, and the DIDO, the drive-in, drive-out workers. Industry estimates and the recent census data suggest there are currently upwards of 50,000 such workers across the country. Internal migration has also played a role. As you can see here, the rate of net interstate migration to Western Australia over the past year is around the highest for 25 years. It's also worth noting that interstate migration has played an important role in the Tasmanian economy, with the situation switching from sizeable net inflows to net outflows and back again over the course of just a few years. For a period in the 2000s, internal migration was adding around 0.5% annually to Tasmania's population growth. Today, it's subtracting about this amount. Now, these structural changes that have taken place across the economy have also altered the relative wages in different industries. Workers in the resources sector have long been paid higher wages than in many other industries, and the gap has widened over recent years, which you can see here in this graph, which shows relative wages in different sectors. Since 2004, average wages in the resources sector have increased by around 10% relative to the wages in the economy as a whole. Workers in the professional services sector have also experienced faster than average wage increases, partly due to spillovers from the mining sector. Conversely, the relative wages have declined in manufacturing, in retail, and the accommodation sectors, and each of those has experienced difficult conditions over recent times. These divergent trends since the mid-2000s stand in contrast to the period immediately before that, when, as you can see, there was less dispersion and arguably there was less structural change as well. Now, the overall impression that one gets from this roundup of facts and figures is the labour market has coped reasonably well with the significant changes that have taken place in the Australian economy. There have been shortages of skilled workers in some areas, but these have been fairly limited. Workers have moved in very large numbers to the industries that are benefiting from growth in Asia and the increasing domestic demand for services. They've done this at a time of close to full employment, and we've avoided increased divergences in unemployment rate across the country. The adjustment in relative wages across sectors has helped, and this adjustment has occurred without igniting the type of economy-wide wages blowout that contributed to the derailment of previous mining booms. Now, one reason that things have worked out this way is that the industrial relations system is more flexible than it was two decades ago. The exchange rate appreciation has also been important. It's helped to maintain a reasonable balance between demand and supply in the economy during what has turned out to be a once-in-a-century investment boom. Another factor has been Australia's monetary policy regime, which has provided a strong anchor for both inflation and wage expectations. After two decades of the inflation targeting regime, there's a fairly broad understanding that unsustainable aggregate wages growth is likely to lead to higher inflation and thus ultimately to higher interest rates. Now, looking forward, it's clear that the structure of the economy will continue to evolve. Over time, the strong growth in investment in the resources sector will give way to a large increase in exports of resources. This will likely mean some moderation in the demand for labour in the resources sector, and other forms of activity and employment will need to pick up. As this transition occurs, the types of new jobs that are created will obviously also continue to change. Inevitably, though, there are uncertainties as to what these new jobs will be and where they are to be located. And in the face of this uncertainty, it's essential that the labour market retains its flexibility. The industrial relations laws and practices are important here, but by no means are they the full story. Importantly, flexibility also comes from having an adaptable workforce, one that has the right general skills, the right training, and the right mindset. Over the medium term, whether or not Australia fully capitalises on the opportunities that the growth of Asia presents depends critically upon the ability of both workers and businesses to adapt and to build and use our human capital. Many of these opportunities actually lie beyond the resources sector, in areas like the unique tourism experiences that are possible here in Tasmania, in high-end manufacturing, in high-quality food, and in professional services. But if we are to take advantage of these opportunities, it is a highly skilled and outward-looking labour force that is critical. I'd now like to shorten my gaze a little to look at the second issue, and that's what recent developments in the labour market tell us about the overall balance between supply and demand in the economy. As I discussed at the outset, the current national unemployment rate is currently around 5.25%, and it's been in the 5 to 5.25% for 2 years now. As I said, that's a very good outcome by international standards. Notwithstanding this, the labour market does appear to have generally softened in recent months. You can see this in this next chart. There's only been modest growth in total employment in the top panel, and there's been a decline in the employment to population ratio in the bottom panel. And various other indicators also suggest a lower rate of job creation than was the case a while back. Now, two industries stand out as having particularly weak employment growth over recent times. The first is the construction industry, where, according to the ABS, there's been a net decline in employment of 70,000 jobs over the past 12 months. Activity in important parts of the industry, including in home building and commercial construction, remains subdued, as does the immediate outlook, and this has led to a fair amount of job shedding over the past year. The second industry is public administration, where employment's fallen by around 50,000 over the past year, with governments cutting back due to a variety of budgetary pressures. One interesting aspect of these recent outcomes is that despite only modest overall employment growth, the unemployment rate has not moved up, as had been fairly widely expected. So I think it's evident from this next chart, part of the reason for this is that there's been a decline in labour force participation. That's the share of the working age population either in a job or looking for a job. Now, while one always needs to interpret these short-run movements with caution, the current participation rate's around 0.5 percentage point lower than the average for the past 5 years, and that stands in contrast to the general upward trend in participation over the previous 3 decades. And the bank has recently spent quite a lot of time trying to understand what's happening here and what it says about the balance of supply and demand in the labour market. Now, on the supply side, demographic factors are potentially an important explanation for what's going on. As in many other countries, the Australian population's ageing, and by itself, this tends to reduce labour force participation as older workers are less likely to have a job or be looking for a job than are younger workers. Our estimate is that this ageing effect by itself has reduced the participation rate by around 1 percentage point since the mid-2000s. Over this period, however, the effect has been more than offset by the higher participation of successive generations of women in the workforce, as well as the tendency for older workers in general to participate in the workforce longer than their predecessors. So taking account of both this cohort effect as well as the ageing effect, it would appear that these longer-run supply-side factors are not a central part of the recent decline in participation. A second potential factor is the relatively high rate of structural change in employment that I talked about earlier. With increased rate of job turnover, it may be the case that workers who have left a job have decided not to re-enter the labour market immediately. And this could be for a variety of reasons, perhaps employment prospects in the immediate area are poor, or perhaps workers are seeking to update their skills before re-entering the labour market. Unfortunately, the existing data make it difficult to assess how important these effects are, but to the extent they are playing some role, there is likely to be a bit more capacity in the labour market than indicated by looking at the unemployment rate alone. A third possibility is that decline in participation is linked to the weak demand in the construction industry that I talked about a moment ago. There's been a large decline in the number of people who identify themselves as being self-employed, and many of these people previously worked in the construction industry. Again, it may be the case that some of these workers are not recorded as unemployed, despite actually not working in the reference week that the ABS does the survey, and actually being available for additional work. Again, if this were to be the case, would suggest there's a bit more capacity in the labour market than suggested by the unemployment rate alone. Now, this weakness in the construction sector, particularly of new homes, has been one of the biggest surprises in the economic outcomes over recent times. Looking forward, a pickup in construction activity is one of the factors that could provide an offset to the eventual moderation in the current very high level of investment in the resources sector. A pickup in other forms of investment could, of course, also play this role. With the peak in mining investment now coming into view, it's not surprising that tension is turning to the questions of what form of activity might pick up, where the future jobs might come from, and what combination of interest rates and exchange rates might be needed to keep the overall economy on an even keel. Now, no doubt, international developments will have an important bearing on the answer to these questions. Recently, the global outlook has softened somewhat, and the various indicators that I have just talked about suggest the labour market has also moved in that direction. Given these developments and the outlook for contained inflation, the Reserve Bank Board just judged at its meeting last week that it was appropriate for the stance of monetary policy to be a little more accommodative than it had been. While there's been considerable discussion and focus recently on the weaker global economy, I think it is important that we do not lose sight of the longer-term benefits to the Australian economy of the growth of Asia. It does remain the case that this growth provides Australia with tremendous opportunities. Over recent years, we've seen these opportunities in the resources sector. But in coming years, we are likely to see them more clearly in a wide range of other areas as well. Our flexible, our adaptive, and our well-trained workforce will be the key to taking advantage of these opportunities. That I'd like to thank you very much for listening, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thanks for the talk, Bill. Could I take you back to the participation rate graph? Sorry, I'm Graham Wells, Economics University. When the crisis first hit, there was a lot of discussion about wealth effects on participation, and the discussion really was about how participation rose as people postponed retirement. And the data that you've got there is certainly consistent with that story. Has the bank done any work on that to kind of explain what might be driving down the participation right now in response to rising stock prices?
Thanks, Graham. We did at the time of the GFC, we did a lot of work trying to understand why the participation rate had actually been so strong around that time, and it was clear when you look at the disaggregated data that a lot of older people were staying in the labour force longer because I think it was because their superannuation had diminished in value and they decided they had to stay working longer to build up their wealth again. Partly that effect is partly unwound, but the unwinding of that isn't enough to explain the recent decline in the overall participation rate, and it's more the factors that I was talking about that are at work now. But it certainly was an important factor in 2008 and 2009.
There's a lady down on the far corner. Yes, thank you.
Marty Dungey, Economics, University of Tasmania. I'm interested, Phil, in your analysis that perhaps the construction sector may be able to be partly responsible for picking up growth again or employment again as the mining sector perhaps winds down. In response to the cut in the RBA interest rates recently, one of the speculations that has arisen is that perhaps that this will reinflate the housing price bubble. How do you respond to those two assets? How do we see the construction sector starting to move again without the house price reinflation occurring? Is there an underlying demand problem there that we're missing?
Thanks, Marty. Well, they're very good questions, and ones that we've puzzled about a lot internally. I think on construction, at least in house building, our sense remains that we've probably, as a country, have not been building enough houses over recent years or enough dwellings over recent years. The national vacancy rate's quite low, and rents are rising at a reasonable rate. It's difficult to understand why we haven't been building enough houses, but I think that's the position the conclusion that we've reached. At some point, it becomes attractive again for developers to build houses and for families to commission the building of new houses. I think we see some signs, some very, very tentative signs that the bottom's been reached there, and we're likely to see at least some modest pickup over the next year. In commercial construction, which has also been weak, I think financing has been an issue. Many developers tell us that it's still very difficult to get financing from banks and other lenders. Over time, one imagines that those financing constraints will ease. The other factor has been the relatively high cost of construction labour, and that's partly because workers are pulled into the resources sector. So as the resource investment boom tails off, then that will take some of the pressure off construction wages as well, one imagines, and that helps the construction industry expand again. But we'll need to see those forces work their way through to offset the eventual decline in resource sector investment. The other issue is that you raised was really about housing prices. I think this is kind of a very important issue, and it's unclear how things are going to work out, because what we're seeing in Australia, and I think we're seeing this in many other countries that have done reasonably well, is quite a high exchange rate and quite low interest rates and reasonable growth in the economy from this combination of interest rates and exchange rates. But the low interest rates does have the potential to increase demand for people to buy houses or to trade up houses and borrow. We're not seeing any signs of that yet, but if we did, I think that would raise concerns. But I think we're still quite a long way from seeing that. The loan approvals to buy new houses are still remain very low, and I don't see many signs of exuberance returning to the housing market quite yet. But in a number of other countries that have this combination of high interest, high exchange rates, and low interest rates, you do see pressures building in the housing markets. And that's something that we'll need to watch very carefully over the coming years.
Thanks, Philip. Is there another question from Philip's side of the room to give him some work? Okay, whilst we're waiting for questions from that side, we can take a question from the media. Would you please stand and identify yourself?
Thank you, Philip. It's Pat McGrath from ABC News. The IMF has downgraded its forecast for the global economy for 2013, including a downgrade for China, and raising the prospect of a global recession. What impact is that likely to have on monetary policy in the short term? A second question as well, if I may. Yesterday, Glenn Stevens told a parliamentary committee that the RBA could have acted sooner in relation to the securency and NPA issue. How does the RBA act and ensure that it acts sooner next time and create mechanisms for stopping this sort of thing from happening in the future?
Well, on the first question of the IMF's downgrade to its growth forecast, which were announced last night, I think it's important to keep this in perspective. There was a downgrading of 0.2 of 1% to their forecasts. If their forecasts come to pass, which is basically 3.5% growth in the global economy this year and next, that would represent around or just a fraction below average growth for the last 30 years. And what's really happening in the global economy is that the advanced economies are growing very slowly, but the emerging economies still are growing quite strongly, and the emerging economies have much bigger weight in the overall global economy. So we're getting reasonable growth in the global economy, but round average, actually. But the distribution between the advanced economies and the emerging economies is different to what we've seen in the past. If we get something like that, 3.5%, bit higher next year in growth in the global economy, then I think Australia is going to be in a good position. The demand for resources in China remains strong over the medium term. I think we're seeing a very persistent change in the relative prices of both resources and food compared to manufacturers, and we're going to be the beneficiaries of that. And there are no major imbalances in the Australian economy, so I think we're well placed to deal with average growth in the world economy. On the issue of securency, I really don't want to say very much about it, other than the governor appeared yesterday. I think he answered questions for, by my calculations, more than 6 hours, which you can imagine would not have been easy. The bank's committed to a high degree of transparency. The governor answered questions until they were completely exhausted. We've provided extensive documentation to the parliamentary committee. We are not able to provide that publicly because of the current court cases that are going on. And as the governor discussed yesterday, we've thought a lot internally about reform of the processes that we have internally, and that we feel that the current processes are strong and robust and would deal with, let's hope this doesn't occur, but the reoccurrence of anything like this again.
Thanks. Another question from the floor, down over there. Thank you, Phil.
Phil Bailey from Tasmanian Chamber of Commerce and Industry. My interpretation of what you're saying up front and some of the recent commentary is that the bank's trying to downplay the notion of the two-speed economy on the basis that the labour market is adjusting pretty well, as it's meant to do. One of the facts that you highlighted was the sort of narrowness of, or the narrowing of the disparity in the unemployment rates and some of the other data. If you look at 2002 or earlier, you might have been looking at sort of 5% unemployment rate in a strongly growing area, which might well have been Sydney, or 12% in a regional area. Now we might be looking at 4% versus 8% in different regions. When that's overlaid with some very weak growth, as we're experiencing here in Tasmania, if there's any growth at all in the economy, isn't that still evidence of very strong regional disparities in economic outcomes?
Yeah. Well, I certainly don't want to downplay the multi-speed economy. It's very real. And I think the employment charts that I showed demonstrate that. The point that I, or at least one of the points that I was trying to make, is that the overall economy, which is what ultimately we're responsible for, has coped with this multi-speed economy very, very well. In previous episodes, when we'd had mining booms, which were much smaller than the one we're currently having, the economy developed all these imbalances in the labour market, in asset markets, and we haven't had that this time. That doesn't mean that there aren't parts of the economy that have suffered difficult conditions. They clearly have. But overall, we've coped well with what's been a very, very big shock. So Tasmania clearly has been on, at least recently, has been on the suffering the downside of the multi-speed economy. The high exchange rates obviously had an impact here, as it has in other parts of the country, but manufacturing and tourism no doubt has had some effect from that. I think at point this experience suggests there needs to be kind of a, this is not just for Tasmania, but a broader change in the structure of our economy. If it is the case that the exchange rate's going to remain high relative to historical averages, which I think is probably going to be the situation, then there are a whole bunch of industries that need to move up the value-added chain, and we need to do that through human capital accumulation ultimately. It's the strength of our ideas, the strength of our management, the strength of our businesses that are required to do that. So in the medium term, this is not just for Tasmania, I think for the country as a whole, the focus needs to be on how do we move up that value-added chain? How do our industries live with what's going to be, I think, a relatively high exchange rate, at least compared to the 1990s? That's the challenge. That's not something the central bank can do anything about, but I think it's the challenge for the community at large and business and government to deal with that.
Another question from the floor, or is there a question from the media? Yes, from the media in the fellow in the white shirt.
David Benuke from Australian Associated Press. People like Paul Howes have said they want Australia to be a country that makes things again, and you showed some figures from the manufacturing sector. What prospects are for a future in manufacturing?
A good question. I see. Well, I don't think Australia can hope to be a producer of mass-produced, standardised manufacturing goods. The level of wages is too high because of the productivity elsewhere in the economy for us to compete in some of those industries. But that doesn't mean that manufacturing doesn't have a future. It doesn't mean it doesn't have a bright future, because there are niche industries where we have comparative advantages, where we have particular skills, where we can benefit from the science and research and technology. And it's those niche areas that build on human capital, that build on the ability of workers to think about new ways of doing things, that I think we do have a future. And you can see this currently in the export numbers. Despite the high exchange rates, there are some commodities of manufactured exports that are doing quite well. Some of them in the pharmaceuticals industry, some are in the advanced mining equipment industry, some are in the advanced scientific and precision equipment. So there are parts of manufacturing that are doing quite well, but I think the idea that we can be competitive in mass-produced, standardised manufacturing goods, those days are behind us. And to return to my kind of the point before, it has to be higher value-added, not just in manufacturing, but in tourism, in education, right across the economy, and manufacturing is no different.
Another question from the floor, is there one? What about, is there any other questions from the media? Well, while you're gathering your collective thoughts, perhaps I could ask a question, changing tack a bit, Paul. I remember in my banking institute days, the Reserve Bank had an office here in Hobart in Macquarie Street, just up from Elizabeth Street, a very sort of active, viable, interesting office. That's no more. I believe the Reserve Bank has offices in other capital cities. Is there a reason why we don't have one here?
Well, we still have a building that's, I think, known, at least in some quarters, the Reserve Bank building. And my understanding is that we recently won a substantial architectural award for, I don't know, buildings of the 1960s. But one of my colleagues came down here to receive that award. The main reason that office was closed is we used to be the banker for the state government, and we're no longer doing that. So we no longer have a banking operation in Tasmania, and as we don't have banking operations in other states as well. We have an office in Melbourne, but it just has a few people, and its main job is to go and talk to business and community groups, and they do come down to Tasmania at least twice a year. They do a presentation for the business community and our liaison contacts about the developments in the economy, and we have ongoing contacts with the public sector organisations in Tasmania as well. So I wouldn't like you to have the impression that we've forgotten what's going on down here. My colleagues come down at least twice a year, and we're in regular contact with the public sector organisations as well.
Okay, thanks.
Robert Rockefeller from Nikon. This is more of a macroeconomic question. I was just wondering if you're able to explain maybe how you see events unfolding in the Western world over the next 5 years, where you have the US and, I guess, Japan and Europe having significant quantitative easing and extremely low interest rates, and how they get back to, call it, an equilibrium sort of position when there's actually so much debt, I guess, in the Western world. Or do you see them more having a low growth type of future like Japan, particularly given their aging demographics?
Well, you've asked some very big questions there, Robert, and I'm not sure that I can answer them, or at least do justice. Probably the first point is that the advanced economies, I think, are on a lower growth trajectory than they had been up until the mid-2000s. It seems to me that's inevitable now. For many years, probably really starting from the 1970s, there was a steady build-up of debt, public sector debt in the advanced economies. And in a sense, there was a contract an implicit contract between the people and the politicians and the financial markets, and the people were offered increasing services provided by the state, and they didn't have to pay for them, or at least they didn't have to pay for them all, and the financial markets financed that, and the level of debt built up. And that whole implicit contract between the people, the political classes, and the financial markets is now being rewritten, and that's protracted. It's going to take, I think it's going to take many years for that to work out. And during that period that it's working out, I think we're going to see relatively weak growth rates, certainly lower than we've got used to in the advanced economies. That doesn't, so coming back to the point I made before, that doesn't mean that the world economy as a whole has to grow sub-trend, because Asia and parts of Latin America are growing strongly, and there's a bit of a growth loss of momentum at the moment, but the underlying momentum is still there. And they account, and I think this is something that people often lose sight of, they account for an increasing share of the global economy, so their weight in global economy. So what happens in those countries is much more important than it once was. So I think we're looking at a world where there's weak growth in the advanced economies, but perhaps reasonable growth in the global economy, and for the reasons I talked about before, we're well placed to benefit from that. I think amongst all the advanced economies, we are the best placed to benefit from that configuration of global growth. But the emphasis, if that's how it works out, then the emphasis, I think, as I said before, will have to be on human capital and being up the higher value-added chain, because in that world we have a fairly high exchange rate relative to historical averages, and the economy needs to adjust to that, and it needs investment in human capital to do that.
Just as an addendum to the answer before last, you mentioned that the Reserve Bank used to be the bank for the state government, but now no longer. My immediate thought was, Will Hodgman, there's a challenge for the future. Any further questions? Right, from the media down the back. Phil?
Thank you. Dr. Lowe, Michael Heath from Bloomberg News. I just wanted to ask you about the iron ore price, which has rebounded about 25% from its September 4 low when the RBA started to prepare the markets for a reduction in the cash rate. I'm just wondering if that was wise to predicate policy on something so fickle.
Well, it certainly would be unwise to do that, but that's not what has happened here. I'd like to dissuade you from the idea that somehow monetary policy has become intimately linked to the daily movements in the Chinese iron ore price. The recent decision to cut interest rates was really predicated around two of the factors that I mentioned in my remarks. One is that the global outlook looks a bit softer than it previously had done, and the labour market doesn't look as strong as the employment growth hasn't been very, very strong recently, and the labour market has softened. So they're the two primary factors. The fall in the iron ore price, while it gets obsessively measured and monitored now, that is not what's driving monetary policy. I might just add that not that long ago, no one looked at the iron ore price. I mean, we have looked at it, and we've looked at it constantly, or I should say consistently. I think where we see a bigger swing is people became in the financial markets, and some parts of the media became much more focused on the iron ore price than we have been.
Is there another question from the floor? Yes, Phil.
Dr. Rowan Bowman is my name. Following on from Robert's question, then, if you have a look at the long-term game that will go on, what do you see as the major downside risks then to the Australian economy if we have slower growth in the Western world and higher growth in the developing world, when a lot of the developing world growth is predicated on growth in developed economies? So what are the major downside risks then to the Australian economy?
Well, something going wrong in Asia is clearly, I think, our biggest downside risk, and that could be because something really goes wrong in in Europe, and then that has flow-through effects into China. But it's really the growth in China the growth in Asia that's the key issue for us. 70% of our trade goes to Asia. The strong growth there is the primary reason that food prices globally are high relative to the 1980s and 1990s. It's the primary reason that commodity prices are high relative to the 1980s and the 1990s as well. So if that whole Asian growth story somehow got derailed, then that would have significant implications for us. I don't know that I agree with your... If you're making this link that Asia must grow slowly because the West grows slowly, I don't think that, in a medium-term sense, I don't think that that's necessarily the case. Because if you look at the history of development of the US economy, it largely grew through own internal momentum. It didn't, you know, trade was obviously important, but it wasn't the thing that drove the US economy. It was internal, you know, it was a continental economy. And if China makes the right policy choices, I think the same path could be there for them as well. You know, 1.3 billion people. It's a continental economy. It can grow without the growth being driven by domestic, by international factors. If it's to do that, it needs to make significant changes to increase domestic consumption and to liberalise the various factor markets, the markets for land, labour, capital, corporate control. All those markets need liberalisation, and they need to do things to make people be prepared to consume more out of their current income. Those things can be done. So if the policy choices are right, then I think China and the rest of Asia can grow for quite a long time with relatively weak growth in the developed world, but it requires the right policy choices there to be made.